Hi, I'm Sammy Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show. Crosstown Traffic from the third and final studio album, Electric Ladyland, by the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
I'm listening.
There's some nice applause there just coming. Yeah, I forgot about that.
The Jimi Hendrix Experience, mixed in stereo and produced by Mr. Jimi Hendrix himself.
Well, was it? Or was it Chas Chandler who produced it?
Well, he started off, but he sacked him off.
Well, Chas Chandler, I mean, it's very interesting because he managed Hendrix, didn't he? And he really broke him because he broke him in the UK. And Chas, of course, was the original bass player from The Animals.
Oh, right.
There you are.
I remember that now from the film.
Yeah, and he went on to manage Slade later on. So there you are, you see. It's funny, isn't it?
It is weird,
Slade
isn't
were
it?
A great band.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Made a lot of money. You know, that Christmas single, I bet it's ka-ching every Christmas, isn't it, you know? Anyway, Jimi Hendrix, I've never liked him. I don't particularly like his guitar playing. I don't particularly like his voice. I'm sorry, but we're about to get a deluge now because of the devotees. And me being a sort of guitar player and stuff, you'd think that I'd be, but I don't.
Is he, as a guitar player, is he like Marmite? Have you found many people who've either really turned on by him or turned off?
It's very rare that you find somebody that doesn't like him.
Right, okay.
And everybody, you know, and they talk about the original fuzz face, because he used a lot of fuzz, you know, the fuzz face, the Dallas Arbiter fuzz face and wah and all those. But I never liked his guitar sound. Because he was, being an American, when he was in the studio, he was using little amps. And everybody says, oh, yeah, you know, little amps in the studio, they sound just as good as big amps. Well, they don't. You know, I mean, we use big and small in the studio, and a lot of people do. But Clapton, you know, when he was doing that original Blues Breakers stuff, he had a JTM 45 on pretty much full. You could hear it, you know?
Yeah.
And that was his signature sound. Alvin Lee, Jimmy Page used a small amp at the beginning in the studio, but then he went on to Marshalls again, AC30s. And it's like, I don't know. But the production is great. I mean, one of my favourite producers of all time, Daniel Lanois, you know, I just love him.
Never heard of him.
Well, he loves Jimi Hendrix, and he says every time he listens to a Jimi Hendrix track, he always hears something different. And then I was listening intently, and I heard that reverse piano, which I haven't heard before, and he's absolutely right. It's great production, very interesting. You know, but I just didn't get him. This is my favourite track, I think.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's just, oh, Watchtower and Voodoo Child and all those things. But I like this one because it's got it's got a good groove, and I like the whole thing.
Well, it's hard, you know, because you say that, and now I don't really want to say anything, but I don't really know Jimi Hendrix because he's never really musically connected with me or been a part of my life, when he's not been any soundtrack to any part of my life, really. I've just known of him, watched the film, and in some documentaries and stuff. Mm. I think it's because I don't really like electric guitar players, really. That's never really been a thing. As I say, like, you're the first person that really connected with me in terms of the language. And I'm not just saying that because you, it just really happened, you know. And it has opened me up to being more open to hearing guitars and sound, and I'm more sensitive now to tone. Sometimes if a guy's got a bad tone, it can be annoying. It puts me off.
Mm.
And a lot of the time, I find people just like twiddle around on a guitar, and they don't really say anything. They're just kind of showing off and don't really want to say anything than that.
Well, Hendrix, he did create parts. I mean, that riff there, it's a lovely little riff at the beginning there and stuff. And in fact, as I'm listening to it, I'm warming to it more, thinking about it. But, you know, it's just something that just doesn't resonate with me. This was recorded, of course, as well, at Olympic Studios, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Mayfair.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of controversy about the album cover, wasn't there?
Yeah, because this is his third album, and he'd written a note to the label. In fact, he had two different labels who were releasing him, because we had Track Records in the UK and Reprise in North America.
Yep.
And what he wanted was, he wrote on this, it's noted that he wrote on this Cosmopolitan Hotel notepad, you know, that he specifically wanted a photo that Linda Eastman had taken of the band. And Linda Eastman's obviously Linda McCartney, who she married Paul later on. And it was a photo of the group sitting with children on a sculpture from Alice in Wonderland in Central Park. So he wrote and said, look, here are the pictures we'd like for you to use anywhere on the LP cover. Any drastic change from the directions would not be appropriate according to the music and the group's present stage. And we have enough personal problems without having to worry about this simple yet effective layout. And the result? It was totally ignored. I mean, and a little bit strangely so as well, because on the one hand, you've got the Americans who basically just used a blurred red and yellow photo of his head when he was performing at the Savile Theatre, taken by Carl Ferris. And then the UK, they got this guy, what's his name now? Photographer David Montgomery. And he took a picture of 19 nude women set against a black background.
That was a reissue later on the gatefold. But anyway, I think it's still, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so it's just like, what is going on? And he was like, it was a bit like, he was not happy.
But that's the one I remember, as you would do being a young lad, you know, seeing that, you know, a lot of naked ladies on the front of an album cover. You do that sort of thing. But, no, it is fascinating. But you see, he really started in the UK. And I'm obviously, I've missed something. I'm sure Dave Lang assessment, because I think he saw him, and he's a friend of ours, and Beck and Clapton all went to see him, and they said he was just unbelievable. But I think it was the raw energy of his performance, and his playing was, obviously great. He played very loud Marshalls live, and I do feel some disconnect. I feel a lot more connection with Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck than
I get that too, because I feel love for Jimi Hendrix. I just wish that I could connect in with him. I feel disconnected too, but that's probably the first time I've really heard a Hendrix track too, where I've gone, ooh.
Mm.
And I've had some like visual imagery of like a traffic jam and stuff, and just going, ooh, I quite like this. You know, just in terms of the first date.
Now, don't hold me to this, but I think he was playing bass on that as well.
He was. Because his mate, I read about this, had formed another band called Fat Mattress.
That's a new, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Fat Mattress.
Yeah, Noel Redding. And he started this other band and he didn't have a lot of time, so he couldn't make it to the studio, so Hendrix ended up doing Alone in the Bass.
Blimey. I played with Noel Redding, you know? Yeah, there you are. You didn't know that, did you? We'll talk about it in a minute.
I can't breathe. Space Junk from the debut album, Are We Not Men?
We are Devo. Are We Not Men? Now, I love Devo, and the reason why I wanted to stick, we sort of shared the selection of these tracks between us, because we've got the album, of course, downstairs. Great album cover. But I was reading the other day in The Guardian about space junk actually falling from the sky and potentially killing people and the amount of junk that's orbiting the Earth and stuff. And, I mean, when they did this, there wasn't as much, of course, but now I thought it's a big problem, you know? You got all this metal whirling around the globe and falling back into the atmosphere. But it's funny. But I just love the lyric of that, you know? I just love it, you know? Walking down the alley, her name was Sally, and she was hit by space junk. It's great. It's great. But, you know, the comedy of it and the humour is one thing. I think the technical premise and expertise behind it and the production is another thing. It really is very clever, and it's beautifully done.
1978 as well. Mm. There wasn't a lot of space junk around then.
Well, not a lot.
No, not as much. I think the only space junk we saw was on the Clangers with Iron Bird or whatever. And... That's what I think about space junk. This metal bird and the clangers on the planet.
Oh, that's funny.
Weird, yeah. Eh?
But who was going to produce this? Was it
David Bowie?
No.
Well, he did actually. Well, this is the story. I love this story. In 1977, David Bowie and Iggy Pop received a tape of Devo's demo songs from the wife of Michael Aylward, who was the guitarist in another Akron, Ohio band called Tin Huey. Mm. And both Iggy and David, as well as Brian Eno and Robert Fripp, wanted to, they were thinking about producing Devo's first release. Mm. And later that year, Devo played a debut show in New York, and David Bowie proclaimed that this is the band of the future and that he was going to produce them in Tokyo later that winter. But eventually, Brian Eno was chosen to produce the album at Connie Plank Studio in Köln, Germany, because David Bowie was too busy filming Just a Gigolo, but he used to help Eno produce the record during the weekends. This is just mates, isn't it? See, David Bowie was a human being. You know, because you can almost astral project him into some kind of godlike status, can't you? And he was actually, you know...
Just a bloke.
He was a bloke.
And he had a weekend off and he
decided
to produce an album, a few beers with his mates.
And what was really cool, though, because Devo didn't have a record deal at the time, so Brian Eno paid for their flights and the studio costs of the band, and all he wanted was a deal for later when they got signed.
Wow.
So he actually believed in them enough to do that. So I just think that's really cool. But, you know, like, the other thing that really got me was that Devo had, like, this experimental band, and the sounds are incredible, but apparently when they first started working with Eno, that they were a bit resistant to his experimentation, and they were quite rigid from the demos that they'd done. They didn't really want to experiment too much with Eno.
Wow.
So what happened was that, this is what they say, Brian found them unwilling to experiment or deviate from their early demos, and they basically, a majority of the tracks were later remixed by David Bowie, but they didn't remix Space Junk.
Well, I like Space Junk.
Space Junk.
Chains of prison moon are shattered by the sun. I walk a road, horizons change, the tournament's begun. The purple piper plays his tune, the choir softly sing. Through lullabies in an ancient tongue, for the court of the crimson.
Of the crimson king.
grey morning's widow's cry, the wise men share a joke. I rush to grasp divining signs to satisfy the hoax. The yellow jester does not play, but gently pulls the strings and smiles as the puppets dance in the court of the crimson.
Court of the Crimson King from the debut album In the Court of the Crimson King, subtitled An Observation by King Crimson, released on 10th of October 1969 on Island Records in the UK and Atlantic Records in the US.
Of A.
Now, what do you think about that?
Well, it got me floating around a bit, that song. It's quite nostalgic in a way of a time. It made me feel a bit like a musical theatre show as well. Has a certain style about it that kind of reminds me a bit of, like, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, that kind of era. It kind of evoked that kind of feel in me, really.
Well, on listening to it again, now bearing in mind all these tracks are from our vinyl collections that we pull out and listen to, the production on that is, in my opinion, better than Pink Floyd. I think that is a most magnificently produced piece of music done by Robert Fripp and the band, because Tony Clark from the Moody Blues was originally going to produce this, but basically they fired him off, and rightly so. And I think the reason why they got Tony Clark in, quite honestly, is that a lot of Mellotron in it. Of course, the Moody Blues were known for the Mellotron, that big orchestral sound.
Yeah.
But Robert Fripp did it here. It's a masterpiece of production. And the drum sound... This does not sound like 1969. It sounds like... Because the reverb they've used on it and the way it's been recorded and the actual tuning of the drums is very, very... You know, it's contemporary sound.
Yeah.
His guitar... I mean, I love Robert Fripp's guitar player anyway. I mean, we talked about Hendrix, and I don't like him. You know, I love Robert Fripp because you never know what he's going to do. He's frippatonics, and all of a sudden you'll hear a... And a bit of a zzz, and a and all sorts of and lots of octaves and he used to use all these Revox tape machines, and that's the Frippatronics thing, and that's why Bowie, of course, used him, you know,
right?
Oh yeah, fantastic.
I had no idea.
Yeah, but what? Oh yeah, man. And Michael Giles, who played the drums on that, I think it's beautiful. And this the first fill, if you go back and listen to it, the first fill, it's almost out of time. It goes, and it just comes in. It beautifully slows down. It's absolutely fantastic. Vocals by Greg Lake. You know, the late, great Greg Lake. What a great vocalist. What a great bass player. The bass sound, fantastic. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You're on fire.
I am.
Go
on. Ian MacDonald on the flute and all these things. But the lyrics written by the very, very... charismatic and amazing guy, Pete Sinfield, who went on. He was talked about by Q magazine as being one of the greatest, most influential lyric writers of that time.
Right.
So there you go. That's just me disgorging, you know, myself of all this information. Anyway.
Do you know what you need to do to listen to that song? You need to lie on a bed of velvet, floating around in like one of those dark tanks or something, and yeah, and a good glass of wine,
yeah,
in your hand.
Never a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
woman, do need a love, yeah.
Small Faces and You Need Loving from their debut album, Small Faces. It was released on the 11th of May in 1966, very good year, on the Decca record label.
Don't you mean Led Zeppelin in 1968? Because, you know, well it's not 68, it was 69, I think, when Led Zeppelin 2 came out. Because that is Whole Lotta Love. The vocal is exactly the same as Whole Lotta Love.
I was thinking it was Zeppelin-esque, you know.
Well, yeah. No, Zeppelin-esque. Our Small Faces-esque. It's outrageous. An outrageous rip-off. And at the end, he goes, woman, you need it. The only thing they don't do is bam, bam, with that. But it's exactly the same. And Jimmy Page, in his book, I'm reading at the moment, defends himself. He said, oh, it's all about my riff, you know, da-dum, ba-dum, da-dum, da-dum. But Robert Plant has ripped it off in total for that track. You know, unbelievable plagiarism.
Ah.
And I love Zeppelin. I love Jimmy Page and I love Robert Plant. But Robert Plant used to go and see the Small Faces live all the time. He used to hang out in the dressing room and everything when he was a lad.
Well, it's funny you should say that, though, because You Need Loving is a thinly veiled cover of You Need Love, written by Willie Dixon for Muddy Waters, who recorded it in 1962.
Indeed.
So there you go, sunshine.
Well, I know.
Everybody's borrowing off everybody else.
Well, yeah, this is not borrowing. That is absolute plagiarism. And Robert Plant should be ashamed of himself for not actually crediting the Small Faces for that track. Because Marriott, and, you know, And Glyn Johns was engineering this as well, which is the incredible thing. I mean, I know Glyn Johns didn't do Zep 2, but Glyn Johns actually recorded it.
Well, Willie Dixon should have flinking well sued Ronnie Lane and Steve Marriott then, because he wasn't credited on the track either. So, you know, let's talk about standing on the shoulders of giants. Let's just see who's actually originated this. And everybody's repeating the plagiaristic...
Well, yeah. Well, Willie Dixon's one of our favourite blues writers. Yeah. I mean, he's written loads of great tunes, you know?
I know where you're coming from, though, but, I mean, it seems that everybody's doing it.
Well, they are. Everybody's doing it, but, you know, and now...
And did it.
Even more than ever. But it is incredible that it's so close. And I'd forgotten how close it was until I've just listened to it again.
It is odd, though, because I don't really know the Small Faces. It wasn't... They weren't really part of me, but I feel them. I know a little bit more now. You know, like you've got a coat that you put on. You go, oh, you can relate to the music more.
Yeah. Well, Marriott, I mean, he was a great vocalist, and of course that band went on to become the basis of the Faces. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because Marriott left, you know. Ronnie Wood came in and Rod Stewart joined, you know, and it was like, it was that band. But great band. Great, great band.
Hey, did you know about, I was reading about Don Arden, you know, because he's always a bit, you know.
He was the manager, wasn't he?
You don't really want to meet him, do you?
No.
Because you do, he's Mr. Yeah. Ooh.
Sleaze.
Yeah, I don't want to say anything sort of too detrimental, but yes.
Sharon, love you.
I know. And I like Sharon. Sharon? Anyway, but so after this song... they had the breakthrough with All or Nothing,
topped
the UK charts. They had a 10-week run with that as well. The follow-up, this is outrageous, right? It was called My Mind's Eye. And it was successful, but it really infuriated the band because they'd given Don Arden just a demo of the song and it was unfinished. And Don Arden had given it to Decca as a finished piece.
And released it.
And they released it. Can you imagine, though? Blinking Nora, I'd be so cross if somebody put a song out that I wasn't ready to release, you know.
Well, the final thing about this track is that Ian Samwell was producing it, or a co-producer of it, and he wrote Cliff Richard's Move It.
Mm-hmm. star. Wheels are made for rolling, mules are made to pack. I've never seen a sight that didn't look better looking back. I was born under a wandering star. Mud can make you prisoner and the plains can bake you dry. Snow can burn your eyes, but only people make you cry. Home is made for coming from, for dreams of going to, which with any luck will never come true. Goodbye forever, it's time for me to go. I was born under a wandering star. A wandering, wandering star.
What can make you prisoner and the plains can make you dry? Snow can burn your eyes, but only people make you cry. Home is made for coming from, for dreams of going to, which with any luck will never come true.
To heaven, tie me to a tree, or I'll begin to roam, and soon you'll know where I will be. I was born under a wandering star.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight, age 3, and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Wandering Star from the 1951 stage musical Paint Your Wagon, with Lee Marvin singing it.
I was 3, and that was my favourite song. I used to sit on my swing in the back garden and sing that song really loudly, like swing and go into the clouds. And my mum used to tell me that the neighbours could hear me down the road, and they were giggling away because there's this 3-year-old doing this really sort of, I was born. But you know, like foghorn, like really loud. I used to love it. And it's just so...
I love this story and stuff.
It's a prophetic thing as well because, you know, I'm a starlight, and it's just really weird because this is my song. This is like this guy. I just loved it. I don't know what it was about it. It was just so... I don't know, just caught my imagination. And yeah, it's always been with me, and I've always grinned. I mean, I'm singing along. I felt like a Muppet, actually, you know, that's just like, you know, for the Muppet Show, because I've got this big grin on my face. And
well,
it's just
a
like,
huge grin. It's not just my, big, it's huge. When
I know,
you
I feel a bit emotional, but yeah. I just love, love, love this song. And Lee Marvin is just really weird, you know, because when you look at it, he's just like this Oscar-winning, Golden Globe-winning actor from that era, and this is his one song that he sang, because when they did the musical in 1969, he didn't want to lip sync, but he couldn't sing, so he's not really a singer, so you can kind of hear him just about going in and out of
tune
of tune, as it were.
No auto-tune in those days, thankfully,
but I love it because I remember the album cover, you know, and just holding it. And And vinyl was such an important part of my life, and I'm so fascinated by the songs, and it was just that tradition, and you're a kid, and I literally was 3. I mean, it was, I was pretty, I had lots of questions when I was a young girl. I was like, how does this work? What does that do?
What's changed?
That's so true, you know. Oh, crikey. Yeah, but it's like this whole kind of, I'm just intrigued by life, you know, and that's why I really love the album title that we're working on now, our second album, you know, the language of curiosity is so us. So many questions and so many ways of things that you need to know.
Mm.
And I'm fascinated by it. Now, this is a lovely... Now, and also, see, on the album as well, I remember that you had that, hand-me-down those can o' beans, hand-me-down those can o' beans, and you sing them like a bloke, you know? And do you, what's really interesting, when they released this as a single, guess what was on the B-side?
Go on.
I Talk to the Trees, sung by Clint Eastwood. And it's great. And so right, so basically, the film, this is so intriguing as well. Paint Your Wagon, the film, was a flop at the box office, but the soundtrack was a huge success. Now, that's really obscure, yeah? So, and it went to number one in the island, or in the island, in Ireland and in the UK. Now, there was a song at the time that it kept off the number one spot. It went to number one. And what do you think was number two and couldn't get to number one because of I Was Born Under a Wandering Star?
Must be something by the Beatles.
You bug. Banana. You guessed right.
No, yeah, that's right. I didn't even know. I didn't look it up.
Let It Be.
No.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Can't Sit Down, Part 1, by Phil Upchurch. And that was released in 1961 by Boyd Records of Oklahoma, with distribution by United Artists Records.
Well, listening to that, you know, the guitar playing was really advanced for the time, you know. I mean, it was really quite tricky. And I detected a Jimmy Page lick in there.
Did you really know?
There's a do-do-do-do-do-do-do, which he used in Heartbreaker. Again on Led Zeppelin.
Oh, here we go.
There we are, and he's ripped it off.
This episode is all about plagiarism.
It is. Philip Church is, you know, the architect of Heartbreaker. So there we are. So that's all I can say about that.
Right.
I don't know a lot about this guy.
I was going to say, who is Philip Church?
Mm.
Don't know much about him at all.
And there's not a right lot about him, is there? But he went on to play with a lot of really cool people, didn't he? B.B. King.
Otis Rush, Curtis Mayfield.
Dizzy Gillespie.
Chaka Khan.
John Lee Hooker. Cat Stevens.
I know.
George Benson.
Michael Jackson.
Ow!
No, stop it. We're having too much fun here. A little bit dizzy, actually.
I know.
I think we've still got jet lag from Australia.
Well, we've come back, and I'm not kidding. We haven't been out of sleep proper since we've come back.
No, we're feeling a bit googly-moogly.
Because we've been so busy, and we've got, you know, we've got this tour coming up in December with the Stark Campbell Band, and, you know, because we do everything ourselves. I mean, we're self-managed, so we do all our own promotion and everything. We do our recording. We do everything, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Including cleaning up and making all the food. It's like we do everything. So it's,
we've had a bit of a topsy-turvy life since we got back, because we've been sort of not being able to sleep through the night and then working through the night and then going to bed for a bit and trying to just get ourselves back onto kind of track, haven't we?
Yeah, it's been crazy, but you know, but it's going to be worthwhile. We're really looking forward to tour in December. That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I am really looking forward to it too. I love meeting the people. We've met so many brilliant people at the Wangaratta Festival. Jazz and blues. Loved it.
Yeah, and it was brilliant. I mean, Frank and everybody that we met, I mean, they were just absolutely brilliant. Great people and a great festival.
Yeah, I know. We need to go back as well at some point.
I think we will.
Yeah.
In every dream home, a heartache. And every step I take takes me further from heaven. Is there a heaven? I'd like to think so. Standards of living, they're rising daily. But home, oh sweet home, it's only a saying. From bell push to faucet, in smart town apartment, the cottage is pretty, the main house a palace, penthouse perfection. But what goes on, what to do there, better pray there. Open plan living, bungalow ranch style, all of its comforts seem so essential. I bought you mail order, my plain wrapper baby. Your skin is like vinyl, the perfect companion. You float in my new pool, deluxe and delightful. Inflatable doll, my role is to serve you. Disposable darling, can't throw you away now. Immortal and life-size, my breath is inside you. I'll dress you up daily and keep you till death-size. Inflatable doll, lover ungrateful. I blew up your body, but you blew my mind. We'll be right back.
In every dream home, a heartache, from their second album, For Your Pleasure, released in March 1973 on EG Records. Roxy Music, of course.
Wow.
I know. I actually think it's one of my favourite 70s tracks, and it's certainly my favourite Roxy track, even though with all the singles, because the lyric is so dark and so wonderful. And his turn of phrase, a bungalow ranch style, and my breath is inside you.
I know.
Your skin is like vinyl.
Mm.
My role is to serve you. I mean, wow. I mean, it's powerful, powerful stuff. Really powerful. You know, and I love all that VCS3 because Eno, I mean, he wasn't a keyboard player, was he? He wasn't a trained keyboard player at all. He just came in and started making a load of racket.
Yeah.
You know, because it was Brian Ferry was really the keyboard player. But again, the production in there is just magnificent. Manzanera, he's not my favourite guitar at Manzanera, but what he's really good at is creating great atmosphere in his playing. You know, he's careful about his sounds and he's careful about what he's playing, and he does add so much to that track. And Andy McKay, you can hardly hear him in that. You know, the sax is a little bit of whitter in the background, but it adds to that thing. And without them all being together, it wouldn't work, if you know what I mean.
No, and it treads that fine line, doesn't it, between, like, you feel that it's a bit it's experimental, and just before it sort of falls off the edge and takes you with it, it becomes a... there's a bit of familiar territory again, you know. It has that real, it's quite, I can't speak actually, because it's just full of feeling.
Yeah, it is. And that phase section at the end where it fades out, and a lot of people fade it out after that and just talk over it, but I like to listen to full track. We talk about this a lot, don't we? You know, you got to listen to the last note, because you know, it's a piece of music. It's not something to be talked over, you know. So it's beautiful, that phase thing. And
I love the fact, you know, it sounds like, because on the LP, the original vinyl LP version, the song was the last, this one was on the last side of side A, and it appears to fade out. And then it comes back in again. So when you're playing the vinyl, you think, oh, the record's finished. You go to turn it over and it hasn't finished.
Yeah.
I love that. That's almost like, you know, making a song and having it repeat like on a scratch. And you go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you go, oh, no, I'm going to have to, like, move the stylus. It's like a little bit of a trick, isn't it?
It certainly is.
An ear trick. I was reading as well, because Roxy Music, I mean, it went through different formations, and I was just reading something in All Music, and this is quite intriguing. It said, before they became a vehicle for Brian Ferry's Casanova act, Roxy Music held sway as one of the edgiest bands on Mother Earth. Driven by Brian Eno's radical keyboard experiments, early Roxy's space-age mix of electronic beer hall kitsch and Sinatra in Furs cool helped jolt a music scene in dire need of a little CPR.
Indeed. And that is the end of the show.
We say it every week, but that, you surprised me then. I was in Roxy Music land.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
What's going on?
Well, if you want to contact us, we're on Instagram, on Starlight Campbell. Twitter is Susie and Simon, and Facebook, of course.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio. And please tell your friends.
And we're going to play out with one of my favourite bands of all time, Deep Purple. Now, I don't like Deep Purple studio albums. Well, the later ones anyway. But this is amazing. Fireball, this is all about the fuzz bass solo.
Fuzz bass? Hang on a minute. Bass solo, did you say?
There's a bass solo. Yeah, you didn't know about this, did you? No, I don't think you listened to it recently.
No.
And of course, Ian Paice's amazing drummer, drumming. One of the unsung heroes of rock music drumming. Our drummer, Steve Gibson, went to a clinic with him the other week. He was pictured with him. Absolutely great. A marvellous double bass drum thing at the beginning. Fantastic, you know. Full of energy. It just blows your mind. Great.